Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to welcome you all here today. I'm John Alterman. I run the Middle East program here at CSIS. And what you're looking at in the front of the room is a very small club. Ben and I are members of a very small club of people who've written books on China and the Middle East. Ben Simbendorfer is chief China economist for the Bank of Scotland. Before going out to China, he spent time picking up Arabic in Damascus. I think it occurred to him, like it occurred to me, that it's hard to imagine a future for the Middle East where China doesn't play a more significant role. And he, like me, was moved to write a book about it. His book, which I have flyers for here with a healthy discount, The New Silk Road, How an Arab World is Turning Away from the West and Rediscovering China, was published by Palgrave Macmillan. It is an interesting read. He also has a blog, silkroadeconomy.com, which just had an entry. I'm trying to think. Today's entry was on manufacturing in the Middle East, right?
Rethinking policy.
Yeah. Rethinking policy. So he updates it actively. I think we're going to have a not only a stimulating discussion, but also the kind of discussion that there's not much of still in Washington. There's nobody better to lead it than Ben Simbendorfer, and I'm delighted to have him here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, all. It's a real privilege to be here, a real honor. So I do appreciate you taking the time. I do genuinely believe we are witness to what is a historical rebalancing in the global economy. And look, I'm not a big believer that the United States is about to lose its hegemonic position any time in the next few decades. But nonetheless, its power is being eroded at the edges, and that's very much what I want to talk about today. The East, and I define that as everything from North Asia into North Africa. Its share of the global economy is rising over the last two decades from just 16 to 30%. It's a significant increase. China and the Middle East are very central to those changes. And in particular, when talking about the rise of or growing relations between China and the Middle East, I need to emphasize, and it's the most important thing I can say today, and that is that it is individuals who are central to the changes taking place. It is not governments. Governments do play a role, yes, but it is individuals who are central to the changes taking place. And a good way to describe that is to start with this slide here. And this is a slide that a typical economist like myself will like to use because it seems to explain everything. China's exports to the Middle East have surged in the last 12 months, and they now, the last few years, they now count are worth $60 billion a year. But most importantly, they've overtaken the United States. So China is now the world's largest supplier to the Middle East. And that's the first time the United States has actually lost that number one position since the early 1960s. And that's as far back as we have data, so it probably goes back further. It's popular to then leave the analysis at that point and say what we are witness to is a symbolic changing of the guard. But to genuinely understand this relationship, we need to dig a little bit deeper and try and understand why those exports have surged over the last decade. And well, we all know why China's exports to the United States have surged. It's because of companies like this, Walmart. This, however, is an Arab Walmart. And that's not tongue-in-cheek. It is true. And the point here is that this is a scene on my right there from Souq al-Hamadiyya in Damascus. This is a small street off that souq. Everything in that street is sold from a single city in China called Yiwu. It's about a four-hour drive south of Shanghai. Yiwu is the world's largest wholesaler of small consumer goods. So we're talking hammers, plastic flowers, inflatable toys. The city receives 200,000 Arab visitors every year. In the main street, there are over a dozen Arabic restaurants. You can eat Egyptian, Syrian, Yemeni, you take your pick. I guess the story I want to tell today is very much a story about Yiwu, and to try and explain what is driving that rapid increase in exports between China and the Middle East, and then to think more broadly about oil and so on. I guess the changes took place over the last 10 years, and primarily to begin with because of September, the events of September 2001. This is the point at which Arab traders started to find it very difficult to get visas to visit the United States, and the number of non or number of Arab nationals receiving non-immigrant visas to the United States has fallen from a peak of 250,000 to just 180,000. Fortunately, Arab traders have an alternative, and that alternative is China. In December 2001, China entered the World Trade Organization. Its exports, as a consequence, started to surge. Less well known is the fact that around the same time, China unofficially relaxed its visa policy. And just a few years ago, it took the average Egyptian trader 18 days to receive a visa to visit the United States, if he received a visa at all. It took the same trader just one day to receive a visa to visit China. So that combination of visa restrictions, the emergence of China as an export manufacturing powerhouse, and in 2004 the rise in oil prices resulted in a rapid increase in the number of Arab visitors to the United to China. And you can see that indicated there by the chart on your right. The increase was particularly strong after 2004. Again, that was the point at which oil prices started to increase rapidly. I think the story of Abdul Madani helps just to underscore the changes that have taken place. Abdul Madani is a gentleman, or he's a Syrian textiles trader I met in Damascus. He has a city in the old city. It's.
You said he has a city in the old city.
Oh, apologies. He has an office. That would make more sense. He has an office in the old city of Damascus. A lot of Syrian traders prefer to have offices in the old city of Damascus because it hides their wealth from the government. Now, Abdul Madani used to trade in American-made textiles. He has a Rolodex of contacts here in the United States, but not anymore, not since September 2001. He now finds it difficult to receive visas, and he does worry about what will happen when he tries to come through customs. So Abdul Madani has started to trade Chinese-made textiles. He's now a regular visitor to China. He has an office in Shanghai where he employs four Chinese staff. He communicates them with by email and by phone. And perhaps most ironically, he now exports Chinese-made textiles using his Rolodex to the United States. So these are some of the changes that have taken place over the last decade. And again, to emphasize it, it is individuals that are central to that change. That's important, in my view, for two reasons. The first is that it makes it very difficult to observe the changes taking place. Okay, they're not going to be on the front of the New York Times. The people who are driving this are often quite low-income people. That just fly below the radar screen. The second point is I think it makes the change more powerful, because if this was a strategic policy initiative taken by the state planners in Beijing, it would be always possible to reverse that decision at some point. But when it is hundreds of thousands, and as you can see on that graph there, in fact millions of Arab traders who are changing the way they behave or interact with the global economy, that is a very fundamental change. It is a change that is also very difficult to reverse. One question I'm often asked is why then, or how does this change differ to China's relations with other emerging countries, such as those in Africa? And I will agree that China's exports to the other emerging countries are also growing rapidly, but there are some very important differences. And here I'm going to use Africa as an example. The first important difference is it is difficult for our Chinese traders to sell retail in the Middle East. There are very strong prohibitions on that. The exception is possibly Dubai. So you just don't see the number of Chinese traders in the region as you do in Africa. The second point is Islam. And Islam is fundamental to the changes taking place. I say that because China has a very large Muslim population of 20 million people. Over the last month, a lot of attention has been paid to the Uyghur population. Now, they account for 8 million of the 20 million. My interest, however, is on the Huizhou population. They account for 10 million of the 20 million. They are the largest share of the population. What's the difference? Well, the Uyghur are what I call territorial separatists who happen to be Muslim. They look very distinctive. They look like they are from Central Asia. The Huizhou have no territorial ambitions. They are spread across the country, and most importantly, they look no different to the rest of the population, to the Hanzu majority. What role do they play? Well, let me give you the example of Ma Guoming. He is a gentleman I met in Yiwu. Ma is Huizhou from the Chinese Muslim minority. Ma speaks excellent Arabic. He learnt his Arabic at an Arabic Chinese, what is officially called an Arabic Chinese school. It's in theory a religious school. He was actually training to be an imam and then gave up because he realized there was more money to be made working as an Arabic translator in Yiwu. There are over 2,000 Arabic translators working in Yiwu. You can hire them for $30 a day. Not all of them speak good Arabic, but many of them do. They're not alone. There are over, well, I found 10,000 other Arabic translators on appointment websites alone. Some of them, or majority of them, are the Huizhu, the Chinese Muslim minority. Many of them are also Hanzu, though, from the Chinese majority. They play what I think is a very key role in strengthening relations between China and the Middle East. So to give you one example, I actually got an email last night from a friend who is from a very large American law firm, and they had tried to set up an office in Saudi Arabia to try and encourage investment between China and Saudi Arabia. His Chinese lawyer had just quit, apparently for family reasons, but he believes because the Chinese lawyer had never visited Riyadh until a month earlier and had decided that was not for him. So he had asked me, do I know any Chinese lawyers who are Muslim? Because they will be better able to deal with that type of environment. And that's often the case you see across the region, is that many of the Chinese traders in the Middle East are, in fact, from the Muslim minority. So in that sense, they do play an important role. They are, however, a very major restraint on China's policy in the Middle East. And Chinese policy in the region is always very sensitive to the sympathies of the Huizhu Chinese Muslims. And again, I say that because you can't profile the Huizhu, because they look no different to the rest of the population. You can profile the Uyghur minority. So there are Huizhu who do have sympathies with, let's say, Palestinian cause, and that is a natural restraint on the Chinese government. So clearly the events in Xinjiang were a concern, and you can find critics in the Middle East of the events in Xinjiang, such as there was an Iranian Ayatollah, Johar Sobhani, I think, who made a complaint. The Turkish Prime Minister, Erdogan, was a fierce critic and called it akin to genocide. And there was popular demand for another one-minute moment against China this time instead of against Israel. And yet, more generally, there were very few editorials in the region that I found that in any way criticized China. And it was a real stress test of the relationship. And I think that was for several reasons. The first of these is that the Arab, the Middle East states still view China as a bulwark against the United States. Okay. Point number one. Point number two is that many of the Middle East states, particularly the Arab states, have their own territorial separatists, whether it's Kurds in Syria, whether it's Shiites in Saudi Arabia. And so there's some sort of identification there with the same problems, recognition that China faces very similar problems. And in fact, some of the editorials I did read had suggested that because of the Xinjiang separatist leaders were based out of the United States, that perhaps this was an attempt by the United States to divide China in the same way it is popularly believed the United States is attempting to divide the Middle East. So there was some recognition there. I would also say that the experience was instructive insofar that we need to view China not so much as the United States, but as Russia, insofar that it can have double standards and it can get away with them in the region. To talk a little bit about oil, there is no doubt that oil is important to the relationship. There is a natural gravity. China will account for 43% of the increase in the world's oil consumption over the next decade. The Middle East will count for 60% of the increase in the world's oil production over the next decade. So inevitably, the two sides will have to draw closer. I would also add to that that just if you look at talk as an economist for a moment and realize that China's oil demand will increase by 8 million barrels from 8 million barrels, so it will double over the next decade. Very little of that will be provided by domestic production, so they do have to look abroad for that. If you simply look at the figures here and you see that two of China's biggest suppliers, non-Middle East suppliers, Angola and Kazakhstan, they produce less than 2 million barrels of oil a day. By contrast, in the Middle East, you have Saudi Arabia at, 10 million barrels, Kuwait probably around 4 million barrels. So clearly, the ability to supply that increase in oil must come, or the Middle East has the ability to supply that increase in oil demand from China, and I don't believe China's non-Middle East suppliers do. So a natural gravity to the relationship. That said, I don't believe they're natural partners. They're not natural partners because you have, on one hand, using Saudi Arabia as an example, a orthodox Islamic state, and on the other you have what was a socialist but increasingly capitalist Asian state. And to give you an example of the difficulties, I spoke with a senior executive at Total the other day in Beijing, and he said that when the Kuwaitis, this was his view, when the Kuwait National Petroleum Company proposed an investment in the southern Chinese city of Guangzhou, the partner, I think, again, was Sinopec, they did request that there was an American partner involved. And I think Exxon is up, has put its hand up for that deal. The reason given was there was the Kuwaitis said that they wanted an intermediary. They didn't understand the Chinese. And they needed an established, a partner who had already quite well-established operations in China. And Exxon is that case in point. And I would agree with that. I would also say that China is, for all the fact that China will struggle to look to Africa or the Central Asia to supply its increase in oil demand over the next decade, that's certainly what they are attempting to do. For all the talk about its strategic interests in the Middle East, clearly the big oil companies are looking as far abroad as they possibly can into Latin America as well. I would also say China is investing very heavily in alternative energy production. The mayor of Chongqing City, a major city in the center of the country, just said last week he would like every car in the city to be run on electricity within 10 years. I think that's not unreasonable given that Chongqing is one of the country's largest car producers. And clearly there is the public commitment at the moment to spend on infrastructure to support growth, such as enabling cars to be able to recharge wherever they are in the city. Finally, I would suggest, and this has been one of the disappointments that I discovered as I wrote the book, there are two journals that are published out of China that look at Middle East issues. And when I discovered them, I thought, hooray, here's the mother load, I can use these and reference them. There were some very interesting articles there. When I looked to the footnotes, and this was consistent, when I looked to the footnotes to see the sources, they were sourcing U.S. neoconservatives. Every single article. So there just isn't.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. But it was interesting. That was their primary source. There is just not a long history of Middle East studies, particularly Gulf studies, in China to support the growing relationship. In fact, that relationship or the focus on the Middle East has been challenged over the last year by the economic crisis because China has seen that as an opportunity to cement its position as a major world power. And you may have heard a lot of talk about the G2. I have a friend, for instance, and this is not the only case, who was focused on China Middle East studies at one of the research institutes and was basically transferred to look at G2 issues on the recognition that this is where the real focus should be. So I think that is a major restraint to growing relations between the two. So just to finish up here, what might the relationship look like over the next decade? I think three key points. The first is that China's exports to the Middle East, yes, are growing rapidly, but they are also resulting in factory closures across the region. In the Palestinian city of Hebron, there were 15,000 textile workers a decade ago. There are just 5,000 today. Syrian city of Aleppo, a number of textile factories have shut down as a result of Chinese imports. The Syrian government has responded by imposing tariffs on those imports. I guess for a region where you have 60% of the population under the age of 30, the risks of factory closures is quite serious and could sour relations with China, but at the same time could be a source of social unrest in the region. I think eventually Chinese manufacturers will be forced to outsource production to countries such as the Middle East. As the currency has appreciated almost 20% in the last few years, it will continue to appreciate. land costs, environmental costs are all rising in China. Now, I have to be a realist here. I do recognize that it's not easy investing in the Middle East. Productivity rates are lower. There's a lot of red tape, capital controls, and so forth. But it's important to put the figures into perspective. This is China's exports to Europe versus Syria's GDP. Syria would only have to capture 1% of the increase in China's exports to Europe to add half a percentage point to GDP growth. So we're only talking about a very small share, which is feasible. And I did notice that the Chinese auto manufacturer, Geely, just 2 months ago now, has made an investment outside of the Syrian city of Hama to produce cars in Syria and for export into Europe. So there is change taking place. My second point here would be on the importance of closer cultural ties. Good example of that, it's not just about commerce, good example of that is the Chinese language author, Song Hongbing. He wrote a book called Currency Wars, in which he described how the West has used its currency policy to prevent the rise of the East. He talks specifically in one chapter called Financial Nuclear Weapons Target Tokyo, in which he describes how the Plaza Accord, signed in 1984, was used deliberately to produce rapid appreciation of the yen and the collapse of the Japanese economy. Some people will say this is conspiracy theory, and maybe so, but a large number of senior Chinese officials read this book. It's not just popular in China, it's also popular in the Middle East. I was watching Al Jazeera the other day on Balah Hadood, the chat show hosted by Ahmed Mansour, and who was he interviewing but Song Hongbing? Via a translator, and Al Jazeera had felt that the ideas in this book had resonance in the Middle East. To give you another example of that,
what was the translator?
Sorry,
translator pretty good.
It was okay.
Okay,
yeah.
Just checking.
To give you another example of that, earlier this year, I think in March, I noticed through one of the local newspapers in China that the Syrian governor of Al Hasaka, a northeastern province neighboring Iraq and Turkey, was visiting a Hunan province, a central province. You might ask why, because if a Syrian governor is going to visit China, you would think it'd be a junket. Hunan is not a sort of place you have a junket. It's poor, it's agricultural, it exports a lot of labor to the wealthier cities. But he was there on a study trip, and he was there with a part of a large group on the assumption that Hunan had a lot to teach or a lot to offer in terms of his own experience, given that his province is poor, agricultural, and exports a lot of labor to the wealthier cities. And I think this is an important role that China is playing, is that it is offering, look, it's economic reforms. China's growth model is not miraculous. It's very similar to the United States' growth model. It's built on free markets, free trade, and capital markets. The difference, though, is China has put all this into practical experience. And for, say, President Mubarak, who is a regular visitor to China, to go from Cairo to Beijing, you can see how you get from point A to point B. To go from Cairo to Washington, it's point A to point Z. So China has an experience that, as Syrian President Assad has said, he calls it the Tajribat Siniyat, or the Chinese experiment. And I think it's given these countries confidence to push ahead with their own economic reforms. So again, just to finish up here, I think I would have to emphasize that first, I think there is China's relations with the Middle East. There is a threat there to the United States, but also an opportunity. I don't think interests are that divergent. I think China also wants a stable Middle East. It wants low oil prices. Nonetheless, it's a very difficult relationship for us to map and observe because it's an organic relationship. We can't simply understand it by reading the statements that are made by Beijing or Riyadh. We need to be tracking the activities of what can be millions of individuals. And that makes it very challenging. But nonetheless, I think quite a powerful change. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. One of the things that has struck me looking at this relationship is that each side sort of wants something differently. Speaking to the government folks that I have spoken to about it, on the Arab side, there really is a desire to bring in China as an asset to complement the United States. And on the Chinese side, I find there's this sort of sustained frustration that there's not more they can get from the Arab side. I mean, they have no interest in confronting the United States to try to sidestep that. But I remember talking to somebody in the Chinese embassy in Cairo saying our trade balance is 10 to 1 in our favor. But the Egyptian, there's nothing the Egyptians make that they can make cheaper and better than we can do. So they're sort of reduced to oranges and alabaster and I think some cable. And that's it. So I mean, is this sort of sense that each side wants something very different from the other? Neither side wants to give the other what it really is looking for from their perspective. How does that grow? Does that mean that they sort of stay static, or does it turn, or do they figure out complementarities through this sort of micro bottom-up way of just working things out?
I think it's a huge problem, actually, and there are two potential trajectories here, and one of them is good and one of them is not so good. Clearly, the not-so-good trajectory is that these imbalances worsen, which is a potential over the next 5 years insofar. If you're a believer that global growth will remain structurally lower than over the last 5 years, China will persist with policies that support its, subsidize its exports to these countries. And that's very much. The currency is unchanged for a year now. It's increasing VAT rebates on exports of these sort of low-cost goods. I would imagine imbalances will worsen in that case. The best thing for the world is Chinese rebalancing. And look, we talk about this in terms of reducing the trade deficit between China and the United States. I would say it's arguably more important for reducing the trade deficit between China and the Middle East and the rest of the developing world, because there is more direct competition, there is the risk of higher job losses, and we have governments that aren't fiscally strong enough to smooth the adjustment. So I think that's a major risk. If we get that rebalancing, if we do get a stronger currency, if we do get an economy where consumer demand starts to rise, I do think we'll start to see outsourcing. And all of a sudden, it may not be that Egypt will be producing goods for export to China, but it will be producing goods on behalf of Chinese manufacturers for export to Europe. And again, it would only take a very small share. It would only have to capture a very small share of this export manufacturing to really benefit the economy. And it could be, there are a number of reasons, not just free market forces. Well, to some extent, free market forces. Oil prices at $70 a barrel or higher will mean that transport costs become increasingly important. And it may make less sense to ship goods from China to Europe. Protectionism is very important. If you do see, as a result of very weak growth in the next 5 years, protectionist barriers start to raise, Chinese manufacturers are already talking about this. The way to get around that is to build export factories or factories in other countries. So in some respect, protectionism actually might be very healthy for the developing world. But in terms of, let's say, Egypt exporting goods to China, you know, I'm really struggling to think about what they might just export. It makes it really, it's really tough.
If I could open this up to questions, if I could just ask, A, that until everybody's had a chance, or ask just one question, that you identify yourself for people who don't know you, and third, that you ask your question in the form of a question, which is to actually have a question and not make a statement and say, what do you think of my statement? Rafi.
Rafi Danziger from APAC. You spoke about the Middle East in general, and you focused on the Arab countries. Could you say a few words specifically about Iran, China and Iran?
I have to say, Iran is not my specialty, but I could certainly say a few words. Iran is a little bit exceptional because there is room for China to take a strategic position, unlike in the rest of the Gulf. And for that reason, it does see Iran as a special case. At the same time, Iran is let's say different to the Saudi Arabia because it has a far stronger relationship with Central Asia and ultimately the Muslims in Central Asia and ultimately separatists in Xinjiang. So again, for that reason, China views Iran as a special case. China's exports to Iran have grown rapidly, but if you look at the data, Korea and Malaysia's exports to Iran have grown rapidly. There's nothing really exceptional about that. Clearly, there are some very big Chinese companies operating in Iran, such as Norinco, was helping to build Tehran's underground railway. I think ultimately, Iran is a very large oil supplier to China, at about 12% of China's total oil imports. So, insofar that China is trying to diversify its oil supplies, It would be very reluctant to do anything that might disrupt those oil supplies from Iran. That said, the biggest influence in China's foreign policy is the United States. China will always defer to the United States if it believes that its activities in the Middle East are at risk of upsetting its relationship with the United States. So an instance of that is the Yadavaran oil or gas fields that I think China signed a deal to invest in those 2004, maybe a bit after.
I think they signed a deal in 2004, but they went forward in 2007 after the United.
Exactly, and there was very little action on that for a number of years, and there are some, you would have a view on this, who believe that was in deference to the United States' interests, given that the United States had a very large military force just next door to Iran.
I mean, my view is whenever the U.S. has really sat on the Chinese, they have backed off, and if the U.S. has put it on a long list, the Chinese have ignored it until it was on the top of somebody's list, and then they paid attention. And this has to do with weapon sales and a whole range of other things with the Iranians.
And I would say, too, it's a quite complex relationship. There are a lot of Chinese Muslims in Syria at the Abu Nur Institute in Damascus. And I asked an academic about this. I said, aren't you worried about this? And he said, you know, we're not so fussed about the Chinese in Syria. He said, it's the Chinese in Iran. He said, they're the ones who really worry us. I think the confluence is in most countries, with the exception of perhaps, with Iran is an exception. Yemen is possibly an exception, depending on what happens over the next few years. Libya is a possible exception, but I don't. Libya is playing hardball with the Chinese. I would leave it at that. I think otherwise, the confluence of interest is great, and I don't think it'll happen. But I'm a big fan of the industrialized world encouraging the Chinese to get into the Middle East and build the infrastructure that will help them to export to the rest of the world and give them, you know, say to Syria, you know what, you can, well, they have, you can open a stock market and the regime is not going to fall. I would be a big supporter of that. And yes, it will strengthen relations between China and the Middle East countries, but it will result in stronger jobs growth, income growth, and so on, and greater social stability. China-Algeria is really something to watch. And I say that because it's one of the few countries, Yemen to a lesser extent, where the Chinese are in there in the same way they are in Africa. I mean, the Chinese are building, the China State Engineering Construction Company, you can now buy stocks of this company, is building an Algerian foreign ministry or buildings for the Algerian foreign ministry. It's got 9,000 employees in the country. It would claim that the technical skills of the local population are not adequate to employ the local population to build these. I think Algeria is different, and because of this, there are a large number of Chinese in Africa, which is fine, but what's different about Algeria is the Muslim element. And I think Islamic Maghreb, or Al-Qaeda in North Africa, is a good example of that. You have this convergence of both large numbers of Chinese and Muslim fundamentalists who see the world, who view their actions through a world view. And so I think potentially there is serious room for conflict. And the fact that, you know, Islamic Maghreb did threaten those Algerian workers was quite interesting. And, you know, the company that picked that up, Sterling Assint, I was having a beer with the guy a week before all this came out, and he said, oh, look, we've just come across this news. They actually employ someone who was an extremist who has access to these websites. So they went to the Chinese foreign ministry and told them about this. The foreign ministry said, don't call us again. We're really not interested. But a week later, the Chinese embassy in Algeria did post a document on their website in Chinese language that did say, and because of the events in Xinjiang, that was interesting, did actually link the events in Xinjiang. We have received these threats. Chinese workers have to take care. So I think Algeria is something to watch.
One of the things that's happened in the last, I think, year is that the United Arab Emirates has started exporting oil to China. It previously had exported oil to Taiwan, as I understand it, and was one of the few countries in the Middle East that actually had, that actually was not, one of the few oil producers that was not exporting to China. That's changed. Is that purely commercial? Is there something something else going on? And how well have Middle Eastern countries played the Straits issues with China and Taiwan?
I have to say on that, I'm a little bit ill-informed. I would say it's commercial. I would say, you know, the Chinese have been interested for a while to invest in the UAE's oil sector, and the UAE is not really being that keen, to the point where some of the big sovereign wealth funds in the UAE have tried to gain what is called qualified foreign institutional investor status to be able to invest directly in Chinese stocks. The Chinese have said, well, we'll let you have that if you give us a deal on your oil sector. And so they're at loggerheads at the moment, and that's been an obstacle. On the Taiwan card, I was meeting with Al Jazeera's correspondent in Beijing the other day, Azatra Shahror, and he was saying to me that they haven't played it very well. And in fact, that because of growing that relations between a number of countries in Taiwan have strengthened, and in fact, that's been a little bit of a spoiler over the last year for relations between those same countries and China. In fact, I was watching a Taiwanese cooking show the other day. I do have better things to do with my time, but it was funny that they were actually had a segment on how to prepare halal food because Arab tourists in Taiwan are now a decent money earner. In fact, Arab tourists in Hong Kong are a big money earner. You see them wandering around some of the, particularly Gulf tourists around it, some of the big shopping malls. So it is a potential risk. I don't think they play it very well.
Daniel Silverberg at the House Committee on Foreign Affairs. What do you think that the United States can do, and particularly the U.S. Congress, to take advantage of the opportunities you alluded to with regard to the expanding Chinese Middle East connection?
I think it would be to seek areas of cooperation in terms of economic reform. And it may be simply that it has to be, the two embassies in Damascus touch base on some of these issues. I have to say, though, I've put this to a number of people, including some at the Council on Foreign Relations, and they looked at me and said, it's never going to happen. It's just too tough and too sort of micro to focus on. But I would say it would have to be at the level of the embassies to seek some sort of cooperation. So I don't really have a more complete answer than that. All I can say, though, is that if the United States was to play this card at a very public level and to say, look, we think the China growth model is great, you've done a fantastic job, why don't you export to that, to the Middle East? That would play incredibly well in China. I mean, that's what people are looking to hear. And I don't, look, it comes at some cost. China's relations with those Middle Eastern countries will strengthen. But I think the net benefit of the United States are worth making that play.
Hi, Anram Shami from the Embassy of Yemen. And thank you very much for your presentation. As you mentioned, we're missing a lot of data, honestly, to know exactly what's going on, especially when it comes to trade. I just wanted to know a little bit about the nature of the relationship between China and Yemen, and what's the top industries that they're going on.
It's mainly, again, cheap consumer goods. I know that the Chinese have been investing in fishing. I haven't followed that one up. I don't know if there's a large. I'm not quite sure what the fishing meant. It's mainly cheap consumer goods. To be blunt, I also have to say, I didn't realize this, but I know the Yemeni authorities have just shut down a large number of Chinese massage parlors in Sanaa. So I don't think the relationship is all that healthy at times. But I emphasize that point because I do think one of the challenges for China and its foreign policy is that because individuals are central to this change, it's very difficult for Chinese government to keep those individuals on a leash. And increasingly over the last... Sorry to diverge. I think it's an important point, though. Increasingly over the last year, I'm starting to see articles from people at the Ministry of Commerce who are saying, you know, the illegal behavior of Chinese traders is a real problem for us. The fact that we are flooding these markets with fake goods is a real problem for us. So it'd be interesting to see how that plays out. But in Yemen, I guess the Chinese do see an opportunity there insofar it is a difficult market to operate, but that makes it that provides more scope for the Chinese to enter as opposed to, let's say, the Europeans or so forth. Beyond that, the relationship has actually been quite long. China's imported... some of its early oil imports were, in fact, from Yemen. I think increasingly that's not the case. But it's a fairly long-established relationship.
Are they trying to get involved in the gas sector?
I'm not sure.
You know that road to Hodeida was built by the Chinese.
In answer to the second part of the question, no, in part because I think the Chinese have stepped back from that, the Iranian nuclear program, as I understand it, and fairly much acceded. We don't entirely know, but they seem to be playing ball there. It's a good question. In terms of how the Gulf, or how do the Arab Gulf countries view China's relationship with Iran, I haven't heard it referred too much, and no one has ever really brought it up to me. And I guess it might be in part because it is largely a commercial relationship, for what we know, and that there are arms sales, but it doesn't seem to be arms sales of, it seems to be ammunitions, rather than, as I understand it, jet fighters and so on. It's interesting. That's actually a good question. I have to say, when any of the Arab leadership do visit China, it's not something they mention. Short term, it's zero sum because of the economic crisis and the flood of exports. Over the medium term, I do think there's a potential for there to be more cooperation, but it will take effort on the part of all sides. And I don't think they're... I think this is one of the big challenges for all of us. I think in the financial sector, it's very easy to look beyond geographies because you follow the money, rightly or wrongly. In the, let's say, political and military sectors, it's far more difficult to look beyond geographies. And it's the one thing I've been asking analysts while I've been here, and it seems to come up repeatedly, that there is a huge opportunity cost to going outside your geography because you've invested so much time in that. And I think that's also true in the case of China. And I think that makes it very difficult for all these sides to talk. It makes it, I think it makes it difficult to sort of reach cooperation.
We talked a lot about the trade, particularly in small items, which is not really something that the United States or European companies are going to compete with.
Mm.
The area you didn't talk about, which I am sure is of most interest to these companies, is contracting, particularly major projects. Saudi Arabia has announced that even with the lower oil prices, they're moving forward on a very ambitious program. Some of the other places, like Dubai, have obviously cut back. But if you're looking at, have they broken in effectively and competitively into that market, which has been so dominated by U.S., European, and the Japanese?
Mm. Have they broken in? They have at the very low end. So they are building railways. In fact, China Railways Group just came out with its first half earnings last month and said that its overseas business is now its biggest growth area, and it earns its margins are 3% higher than they are back at home. So railways is a big area. Apartments are a big area. And I think that's the main focus so far. That there are aluminium facilities being constructed. These are all areas in which China has a competitive advantage. I think if we're talking about school, it's low-end contracting, in my view. But it is definitely a growth area. Part of the problem is that there are no statistics on this. So it really is a measure. Each of the Chinese embassies do have economic affairs bureaus. They will report, some embassies will be better than others and will report the contracts that are in place. But it really is a case of looking for contract by contract. Try and find the scale and the worth of those.
In Algeria, which is one of the cases of the highest level of employment, somewhere between 30 and 40,000 Chinese in Algeria, $17 to $18 billion in project finance, including building two-thirds of a road that goes from Morocco to Tunisia, I think, that crosses the whole country, and Chinese companies are building too. So in a country with high unemployment, you have these Chinese workers who come in at lower wages, don't make trouble, leave. They're also building huge apartment complexes, as Ben said. So building housing for people who don't have jobs. And then they go home. And this is an issue for the Algerians. The other sort of interesting aspect of all this is as the Chinese try to sort of put down roots and they try to set up these Confucius centers that teach Chinese, in Cairo, they've set up an elementary school, they started with kindergarten. They had like 1,800 applicants for the first class of 60 to teach Chinese. They keep trying to teach Chinese to Algerians, and the Algerian government won't give them permission to set up Confucius Institutes and everything else. So one of the constraints on the growth of the Chinese market is they can't find Algerians who can interface with Chinese.
That's interesting.
It's a bunch of fun stories.
James Chen, also with the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. I came across an article recently about, I suppose there's, I don't know if it's the China Railway Company that's building the railway line to Mecca and Medina. Mm. And they were saying that there were some complaints from the locals, and so they had 600 Chinese workers that were there converting to Islam. Mm. Is this something that's characteristic of Chinese trading behavior, just basically adapting to whatever the local customs are?
Was that conversion just to allow them to build the railway, or was it genuine?
That's what it seemed like.
That's interesting. But it's funny you should say that, because there was a great story the other day. I didn't follow it, but they were saying this big group of Chinese Muslims from Ningxia province had just stepped onto a train. It was quite descriptive article. Just stepped on a train. They're off to Beijing, because they're off to Saudi Arabia to build railways. So it might be that's why they're being brought across. I mean, the Chinese and Taiwanese at a commercial level, and probably be able to answer this better than I can, but they interact quite closely, and almost to the point you wouldn't think there's a problem. And, you know, if you're on a flight from Hong Kong to Riyadh, there'll be Chinese and Taiwanese merchants there, and the Taiwanese will own factories in Guangzhou, and there'll be, there's absolutely no issues. At a government level, it's obviously a very different thing. I haven't seen any big Taiwanese presence in the Middle East, not the same scale of the Chinese. So the second question. The Chinese need intermediaries in the Gulf, I think, not in the Levant. I think they are, when you meet Egyptians and Syrians in China, there's not really any issues. And I think it comes down to the fact that we're talking about countries that have a very rich history of trading. They're countries that are not homogenous. Certainly in the case of Syria. So they're very used to dealing with other cultures. And there, I think the problems are less. And I would think Africa is probably pretty much the same. There's... it's much easier. I think it's the Gulf that's the sticking point. Yeah.
Rafi, last question.
You mentioned briefly Chinese arms sales to Iran. Can you talk about Chinese arms sales to Arab countries? Do they exist, and to which countries?
I'm not an expert on this, and I have looked, but not seriously looked. I haven't found much evidence of it. And I think, again, apart from there was the missile sale to South, intermediate ballistic missile, I think it was, to Saudi Arabia back in the mid-1980s, I think, again, this is deference to United States' interest. I think they recognize that it would be small change in terms of their exports, but they have a lot to lose. If it was to happen, I would be surprised, and to me that would signal a very important change in their policy towards the region.
And, of course, Chinese-Israeli trade in the security sector is robust, right? Sometimes too robust for American taste.
Can I just add one thing? Because I haven't talked about that China-Israel relationship. Very important. It's often underappreciated how many senior officials are very pro-Israel, in short, whereas there's assumption that most are pro-Arab, and that's just not the case. And it's largely because there's a recognition it's easier to identify with Israel. Senior officials will say, well, look, here we have an economic power, a military power, and a country that has... 3,000 years or more of unbroken history. And it's very easy, I think, for the Chinese to identify with that and say, that's who we want to be. And I think that does, to the point where I actually have Chinese academics who are pro-Arab, they do actually complain about this. And they say, these senior officials. it's also, if you look at on some of the chat forums after such as the... Israel-Hezbollah fighting. I thought the comments in those chat forums were fairly even-handed. I thought there were as many pro-Arab as there were pro-Israeli supporters. And I think the feelings felt by many senior officials are also felt by much of the population. It's much easier to identify with Israel. And I think our view of China's relations with the Arab world are in part skewed by the events over the last 50 years, where it was natural for a socialist government to support socialist causes. And that's not the case anymore. That's simply not the case anymore. And I think the Israelis do a fantastic job in Beijing in particular of promoting Israel. And One ex-Gaza correspondent for Xinhua, he said he was complaining. He said because, you know, the Israelis had invited him around to talk with him before he even went to Gaza. He said, you know, the Palestinians never even bothered to speak to me. Never even bothered. So I think that's a very important part of the relationship.
Great. I want to thank Ben for coming and shedding light on something that I think we continue to need to learn more about. I appreciate you all coming. We look forward to seeing you at our next golf roundtable. Thank you.
Thank you very much.